When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Anfield.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Analysing Anfield from the Liverpool Echo. I'm Beth Lindop and I'm joined by Kiefer MacDonald. Kiefer, how are we?
Very well. Very happy. Liverpool are doing well, which makes my life and our lives easier. So, yeah, can't complain.
It does indeed. I mean, you mentioned Liverpool doing well there. I did have to remind myself what's happened since the last time we did this pod a couple of weeks ago. So, since then, Liverpool have got through to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup after beating Southampton. They beat Nottingham Forest, they've drawn with Manchester City, and they've also got one foot in the Europa League quarterfinal. So it's been a really busy, really successful couple of weeks for Liverpool, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that part of the season now, isn't it, where there's a game every two or three days. I mean, even as us working in the industry, not playing, but it just feels at times like you are playing. I mean, you know, like I say, it's every two or three days, different competitions, and it's pretty relentless. And that's without even thinking about the kind of injury troubles that Liverpool have had, and you know, so many big games in that time. You've obviously had the cup final, you had, you know, games against Arsenal, games against City, you know, your title rivals. So to say Liverpool have come out at the end of this, you know, 6 or 7, 8 week period, you know, in a really strong position, as you say, one foot in the quarterfinals of the Europa League, a quarterfinal of the FA Cup to come against Manchester United on Sunday, and, you know, having put that performance in against Manchester City, which I'm sure we'll touch on shortly, I don't think there can be too many complaints, really.
Yeah, I mean, City obviously is the big one. That's what we're going to dive into today. How do you sort of see the performance and the result as a whole? Because I'll admit, coming out of the ground on Sunday, I was a little bit disappointed, a little bit frustrated. But I think that more is down to the fact that Liverpool played so well in the second half in particular. On reflection, though, when you consider how many players Liverpool had missing, when you consider that they're still bang in the mix to go on and potentially win this title, do you settle for the point?
It's difficult, isn't it? I was the same as you. I mean, at half-time, I said to my brother that I would absolutely snap your hand off for a point. And then within 5 minutes, you know, when McAllister scored that penalty and kind of the spell that followed after that, you're absolutely dying for 3 points. And in the end, you know, even if you forget the kind of incident between Doku and McAllister, even if that hadn't have happened and, you know, Liverpool shouldn't have had a penalty, you'd still be gutted that we didn't win that game. And as you say, it was just a testament to kind of how well this Liverpool team have rose to challenges, not just this season, but, you know, during Klopp's 8 years as a whole at the club. But I think that one, as Klopp said in his press conference after, was, I think, a performance against City that I don't think we've seen before, you know, to dominate probably the best, you know, ball-playing side in Europe and in the world. You know, we all know what Pep Guardiola sets his teams up like and how dominant they can be. And, you know, to kind of concede after, you know, 20, 25 minutes and then, I think there was a period after that for 5 or 6 minutes where I thought Liverpool, yeah, they might concede again here. And then that's when you're starting to worry. You're thinking, you know, the game could really escape from them. But as I say, they rallied really well. And I think, you know, we'll get onto kind of the tactical elements of that. But, you know, there was a few changes at halftime in terms of personnel and position. And I think that, you know, Liverpool really grew into the game and they really dominated the midfield. You know, Wataru Endo was absolutely brilliant. I think he's our new favourite player in the effort. I mean, funny enough, we were just saying about Achan, they, I think, got going after the City game in one of the pubs after, and it's fully deserved because, you know, I must admit that I wasn't his, I don't think anyone was, to be fair, when he came. I don't think anyone knew a lot about him, but he was a slow burner. And I think, you know, McAllister, when he got injured in December and he had, you know, Endo had to step up for those games against United and Arsenal, you can see that he's just really, really built on that. And that's been his platform, and he hasn't looked back. And, you know, that the knock-on effect that that has had on McAllister and being able to play further forward and kind of, you know, stand up and be counted in games and make decisive contributions. Obviously, he scores a penalty in midweek against Prague, or last week, should I say, and then he obviously gets the penalty against Manchester City. But just the kind of the general performance of the midfield three, I thought was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just before we get into the game itself, it felt quite poignant almost on Sunday, because it was the last game of the Klopp Guardiola era in the Premier League for now and probably forever if Jurgen is right in saying that he's not going to come back to the Premier League, which I imagine he's going to stick to his word on that one. They have been just absolute titans of the world football in general, but since they've been in the Premier League, it's been some battle, hasn't it? And I was just looking earlier on at some of the aggregate stats of City and Liverpool playing at Anfield. So Liverpool have won 4, City have won 1, obviously that one behind closed doors, and 3 draws as well. When you look at the stats in terms of goals, Liverpool scored 13, City have scored 11. Possession weighted in City's favour just slightly, 54% to 46%, but the stats are so close, and I think that really exemplifies how closely fought these games often are between these two sides.
Absolutely, and I think that's what was so impressive about Sunday is, you know, you mentioned the possession there, and that's obviously always been Guardiola's philosophy as far back as, you know, that 2011 Barcelona side, and you know, he took that to Bayern Munich and he brought that to City, and people at times can, you know, maybe aren't thrilled by City's play in the same way that Jurgen Klopp plays with his Liverpool side. But, you know, there's no denying that over the last, you know, 2 or 3, you know, years, you know, certainly after getting that Champions League win last year, they have probably been the best team and certainly probably the most consistent in the Premier League over the, you know, certainly in Guardiola's era. But I think the way, as I said, Liverpool dominated them in the midfield, I think the possession was 53%. And I was just looking at previous games between the two, especially at Anfield, because I think at the Etihad, it's always, you know, it's probably, I always think apart from Anfield, it's probably the hardest place to go in the world and play football. But, you know, just from kind of a ruthless aspect of what Guardiola's teams are like, they, you know, they kind of kill you softly and slowly, don't they? But when they beat City at Anfield in January 2018, that 4-3 game, which kind of felt like the first blow that Klopp landed on Guardiola as a Liverpool manager. And I mean, it was just an absolutely, you know, chaotic, 15 minutes or so when Liverpool scored those 3 or 4 goals. They only had 37% possession that day, or something roughly around that number. And you know, just that's kind of how Klopp's always set up in those kind of games against City, where he's almost not put a low block in, but he's kind of waited for City to kind of surrender possession. And then it's breaking with that front three of, you know, what was Mane, Firmino and Salah. And you kind of let them do the danger in the final third. But, you know, on Sunday, as I say, they almost play City at their own game. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I think that was, you know, down to how solid they were in the midfield. And at first, you know, it was Gomez who was trying to step in, whatever. And I think, you know, De Bruyne and Rodri were experiencing, you know, more space between the lines to play balls, and Foden got in a few times early doors down the left. But I think after that, they made the midfield really compact, and there just was no room for De Bruyne, Rodri, Foden, Silva and all those players to get on the ball. And I think there's a really good clip, which I'm sure you've seen, Beth, is Wataru Endo's number one fan, but I think it must be just before he gets hooked, actually, and I think he gets the ball and then Endo dispossesses him, and then Endo kind of breaks with the ball and De Bruyne kind of just flings his arms up in the air, and then shortly after he's squabbling with Guardiola on the sidelines, and that just kind of shows how frustrated City were. And they really were. I mean, yes, they could have won it in the second half. Doc, if it's the post, and Foden had that bizarre one where Kelly, I think, punched it onto him and it hit the bar. But I mean, they'll you could see at full time when they went over to the away, and I think they were rather pleased with a point, because I can't think of many teams over the last, you know, 7, 8, 9 years that have given Guardiola's team a schooling like Liverpool did in that second half.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers back that up as well, because I think sort of when you sat there watching it, like you say, I don't think there's any team capable of rattling Manchester City like Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. But just in terms of the numbers, Liverpool have 19 shots in that game, which is the most in a Premier League game against Manchester City since February 2013. 12 of those shots came after half-time, which is the most against City in a second half since May 2021. So it's very rare that they're put under that kind of pressure. And I think one of my favourite stats to sort of back up Liverpool's dominance is at the start of that second half is that City's pass completion rate in those first 20 minutes of the second half was only 65%, which for a Pep Guardiola side is virtually unheard of, isn't it? And I think, you know, the sight of Kevin De Bruyne coming off frustrated and having a little bit of a bicker there with Guardiola sort of summed all of that up, didn't it? And I think to Guardiola's credit, actually, because I think a lot of us probably in the ground at the time, and certainly I imagine a lot of Manchester City fans in the ground or watching at home, were probably thinking, what is he doing taking Kevin De Bruyne off the pitch? But he brings on Mateo Kovacic, who completed then 27 of his 29 passes. And I think that was maybe where Guardiola deserves some credit, because I think that, you know, had he not done that, I think Liverpool might have gone on to win the game. And I think Kovacic just brings on that little bit of experience and that semblance of control that I think they were lacking in the beginning of the second half.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they'd gone to more of a 4-4-2, 4-5-1 at that point, and it was just more to, I think, to, as you say, to beef up the midfield and kind of give City that backing that they hadn't had for the last, you know, 25 minutes, half an hour, as they kind of were trying to ride this storm. And as you say, it felt like after that, and then I think that coincided just round about the time that Nunes was brought off and Klopp then tries to bring Gakpo on, someone who's then going to boost the midfield in his favour. It kind of felt at that point, I know there was a few flashpoints after that in terms of chances and penalty incidents, but it felt like one Guardiola kind of got one back up on Klopp, and then Liverpool took Nunes off and kind of had that kind of element of unpredictability taken out of their line. It almost felt like both teams at that point were probably happy with a draw and then thought, you know, there's every chance we could go and score a winner here, but we could also go and lose this. And I think with going into the game, it was massive, but I always said it wasn't a must win, it was a must not lose, because, you know, you're not going to win the league in, what was it, March the 10th, but you can very well lose it. So from that perspective, it was obviously, you know, those tweaks and, you know, Guardiola, that's kind of what he's become renowned for, isn't it? Small tweaks. I mean, you only have to look at John Stones and the position he's playing. That's something that Liverpool have taken up, and Gomez played that inverted fullback role on Sunday, and I think, you know, Bradley did as well for periods. I mean, at one point Liverpool were going to jump down here, it was a 2-1-3-1-2, which, I mean, just if you said that to someone 5-6 years ago, they would have said, like, what are you on about? But that's just the way kind of Guardiola and Klopp have kind of gone toe-to-toe with each other, not just on the pitch but also tactically, and looking for kind of new ways to revolutionise the game. And I think, as you say, Sunday kind of just encapsulated that, and if that is the last time we are going to see, you know, Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool up against, you know, Pep Guardiola's Manchester City, then, I mean, as you say, it was a titan battle, wasn't it? And what a way to go out. I mean, I was discussing it after, and I think at the time you're potentially a bit annoyed that Liverpool missed that chance because of their dominance, but I think you look at some of the games over the years that there have been, and I think not my favourites, because I think Liverpool lost one of them, but the best game you put up there, the January 2018 one, the 4-3 at Anfield, which Liverpool win, as I say, that City at their absolute peak in terms of, you know, performance in the Premier League, that's a Centurions year. The year after that, 18-19, Liverpool are going for the league title, and they lose 2-1 at the Etihad in early January, which I think in most people's minds is probably one of the best games the Premier League has ever seen in terms of quality, in terms of end-to-end. I mean, Liverpool's goal that night, Roberto Firmino, it's like a 30-pass move, and it kind of ends with, yeah, I think it's Trent out to Robertson, he then puts it back in for Firmino, and it's just absolutely brilliant. And again, I put a tweet out last week, actually, when Liverpool scored their 1,000th goal under Klopp, and was like, you know, what's been the favourite? And of course, you got the usual shouts of overhead kicks and whatever, but that goal at the Etihad that night was one that was that came up a few times. I also then think that the 2-2s they had in the 21-22 season, the one at Anfield where Salah scores, you know, probably the best goal of his Liverpool career, and he gets the assist for Mane to open it as well. So that was a really end-to-end game. And then you've got the one at the Etihad later in the season, I think early April it was, and another one where I remember coming out of the ground that day and just feeling like, again, like I'd played, and I can assure you I didn't play. But it's just one of those games, they're so enthralling, aren't they? And it just, you know, they have been each other's nemesis, because, you know, Klopp would probably be sitting here in a normal Premier League era with, you know, at least another three titles, potentially a fourth. But I think there's a mutual respect between the two, even if, you know, that isn't between the two clubs, but certainly between the two managers, that I think they acknowledge that their success wouldn't be achieved, or the level of success that they've achieved wouldn't be done without the other. You know, they have pushed each other to new heights. And I mean, that 17-18 season, I think they won the league by, City won the league, had a United 18 points or something like that, and Mourinho called it his greatest ever achievement, didn't he? Or certainly his best achievement at United, and everyone was like, what? And then for Liverpool to, you know, to go two seasons later and finish, what, 22, 23 points above them, it just kind of shows that swing in, you know, in points that they did, and what a challenge it would have been to kind of catch up with that Centurions team. So I think, you know, I don't think Guardiola will miss Klopp. And I don't think Klopp will miss Guardiola wherever he goes in his new job. But I think this will certainly be an era that we look back on in the Premier League and think, you know, it was kind of a privilege and a pleasure to be involved in and to watch so many of these encounters.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
That was the overarching feeling, really, for me coming out of the ground on Sunday and once sort of the initial frustration had worn off, because I think that was one of the reasons that a lot of fans didn't actually mind the drop points, because I think you could sit back and appreciate that it was an incredible football game. It was so intense, probably the game of the season in terms of the quality on display from both sides, but it had a little bit of everything as well. And, you know, whatever caveats come with Manchester City's success, obviously pending the outcome of whatever happens on the financial side of things, they are a remarkable football team that Guardiola has assembled, and a pleasure to be able to watch them go toe-to-toe with Liverpool. And I think, you know, just another point before we dive into sort of individual performances, to Liverpool's credit, you know, they came back again. It feels like it's been a hallmark of Liverpool's season, but that's 23 points now that they've picked up from losing positions. That's the most in the league. Unfortunately for them, City are also pretty good at that. They've got 21 points from losing positions this season in the Premier League. So, you know, both sides are very good at responding to adversity, but against Manchester City with so many players out, with so much at stake, that's a real sort of tick against Liverpool's name, isn't it, for Sunday?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the fact as well that City had something to hang on to, you know, at Anfield as well. I was sat in the Anfield Road up on Sunday, and, you know, after Stones had, you know, climbed on the hall balls, whatever, and kind of done his big celebration, and they were all kind of going back to the halfway line. Walker was, you know, giving it the big one to the City fans, and he had done an interview, Ante, in the build-up to the game and kind of spoke about never winning at Anfield and the tricks that he was going to implement to try and get that first win at Anfield. And I noticed, like I say, what he was doing kind of to rally up the City fans as he was walking back. And I thought, this is huge for them. You know, this is a place, you know, they don't win at, you know, their only win there since 2003 has come behind closed doors. You know, when you take Anfield's biggest, you know, influence away, which was the supporters during the lockdown period. So, you know, that would have been playing on their minds, and the fact that, you know, they're at a side that don't give away cheap goals either. So, you know, I know the penalty was cheap by City standard, but I think it was, you'd look at it from a Liverpool point of view and think, well, you know, the pressing of Bradley first to kind of put Ake under that pressure, and then Nunes to capitalise on it and beat Edison in that foot race. But yeah, I mean, I was really pleased with it, because it would have been so easy, as I said, in that, you know, 5 or 10 minutes that I initially followed the goal to kind of sink and maybe, you know, especially with so many young lads in the team. I mean, you've got Konsa, Bradley, you've even got players like Endo who will never have played in a game of that, you know, that magnitude in their life. You've got Szoboszlai and McAllister, their first real, you know, taste of an Anfield game against Manchester City. You've got Harvey Elliott, who'd run himself into the ground, you know, over the last 6 weeks, you know, and for the whole season, to be fair to him. So there were so many, like, players who, yes, they all stood up, but it's like they could have had reasons to go the other way and kind of, you know, not show that fight or determination. So I think that was the most pleasing thing. And as you say, it feels like it's been a theme, not only for the season, but I go back 2 years of when they were kind of in the final weeks of that first quadruple chase in 21-22. And it felt like they were going 1-0 down every other week or every other, you know, every 3 days whenever they were playing. And at the time, you kind of mask it and think, well, it's the sign of champions and this is what champions do. But then, you know, last season when it doesn't go that way and you can't come back from it, you think, well, maybe there's a problem here. But, you know, this season, as you say, was it 23 points?
23 points,
and
yeah.
That'll obviously be the most. And, you know, City 21. So it kind of shows if you can keep in good company with City in those kind of stats, you're not going to be far off silver at the end of the season, are you?
No, absolutely not. In terms of individual performances then, because there were some incredible displays out there. You mentioned some of the young players. Joel Quansah, I thought, was tremendous considering he was coming in. You know, I think a lot of people maybe felt slightly anxious when they saw his name on the team sheet. Not, you know, to do him any disservice, but just purely because of the magnitude of the game. But I thought he was excellent. Harvey Elliott ran himself into the ground as well. But for me, the game was sort of the most impressive aspect of the game was Liverpool's midfield, which gives me an opportunity to talk about Alexis McAllister, which I will seize at every available opportunity.
Analysing Alexis.
Analysing Alexis. Yeah, that's a new show coming soon from the Blood Red podcast. He obviously takes and scores Liverpool's penalty. So that's 9 out of 10 pens he scored now in the Premier League. For me, he's got to be Liverpool's penalty taker going forward.
Yeah, I mean, someone actually said after the game, was in the pub, and someone said that they hadn't been so confident about penalties since James Milner used to take them. Mm. And it's mad that because you look at Salah's record and you know, you can't think of too many. I know over the last 12 months, whatever, his record's probably not been great. But, you know, prior to that, you think he's hardly missed any. But it's almost like I always feel with Salah, he doesn't always have a technique. Mm. He always just hits it as hard as he can, which is, you know, great because it's Salah and he can do that and he's earned the right to do that. But I always preferred a Milner side foot or, you know, a Gerrard in, you know, the roof of the net kind of thing, which was like well calculated and well placed. But with Alexis, it was quite similar to that, wasn't it? And I don't think there was any doubt that he was ever going to miss it. And as you say, he's really stepped up, hasn't he, in terms of now with Endo coming into the midfield. You know, obviously they've lost Joe, and so again, Szoboszlai and McAllister have had to adapt to like a new trio. I mean, they haven't played together too many times as a three. Obviously, all came to the club last summer. But the way they complement each other, I thought was brilliant. I mean, you could see in the first half that Szoboszlai was the one going, you know, further forward and making those third man midfield runs. I think he had a header just before half time, which he can't keep down. But you know, on another day, he gets on target, and maybe someone's there to kind of pick up the rebound. And then you've got McAllister, who's kind of like he's kind of the 8.5, isn't he, of the mm-hmm. team. He's not a 10, but he's almost a box-to-box midfielder at the same time, and his work rate's just terrific, and you know, he has the quality to match that. And then you've got Endo, who, you know, for as great as he is, I mean, he reminds me of like, if we were all given the chance to play at Anfield, you'd just run your socks off for 90 minutes one year and you'd just die for the badge. And that's what he's done, you know, since the start of this year, really, since he's been kind of more in a more focused position. He's really stepped up in the absence of Szoboszlai, the absence of Jones. And as you say, Beth, that was how Liverpool got a real stranglehold of the game, wasn't it? You know, it's not bad players we're talking about here. It's Kevin De Bruyne, it's Rodri, you know, mm-hmm. players who scored winning goals in Champions League finals. And I mean, Rodri, I saw start, I think it's 60 games unbeaten he's gone now in a calendar year or something, or 60 games since he's last lost for club and country. And, you know, for probably the last half an hour on Sunday afternoon, it looked as if that run was going to come to an end. And that was because there was some, you know, 16 million quid midfielder from Stuttgart giving him the run around. So, you know, I was really pleased with him. And as a kind of trio to, you know, as I say, they all signed in the summer, for them to kind of have that moment, I thought was really, really good. But yeah, Alexis and Endo were the pick of the bunch for me.
Yeah, I mean, Rodri for me is the best in his position in the world. I think Pep Guardiola said he's the best midfielder in the Premier League a couple of weeks ago. I think Kevin De Bruyne would probably have something to say about that. I'd throw Alexis McAllister in there too, maybe in a couple of years' time. But I thought probably the fact that the official Premier League Twitter account after the match put out a graphic sort of highlighting Endo compared to Rodri, and even the fact that they were being compared to each other is a huge indication, I think, of how far Endo's come in this team. And you know, I thought Rodri in that second half was as poor as I've maybe seen him play for Manchester City, which again is real credit to Jurgen Klopp and the way he set that team up and the way that the players delivered that. Moving on then to Virgil van Dijk, because I mean, we're running out of superlatives to describe his form this season. He's back to his imperious best. He won all of his aerial duels. He had a 97% pass accuracy, 4 interceptions, 3 tackles. I mean, those are the numbers of a player that is at the absolute peak of his powers against, as you said, the best ball-playing side in Europe.
Absolutely, and not only that, they've got probably the most ruthless striker in the world, and probably the most ruthless striker there's going to be, you know, for the next, you know, 10 or so years. And yeah, I mean, to be fair to Van Dijk, it was, I mean, it's nothing that he's not used to, but to have to kind of marshal such a change back four is credit to him. You know, not only that, but you've got the goalkeeper as well, who's, yes, he's experienced, but he's not played an awful lot of football over the last 12 months, has he? So, you know, for them to kind of come in from the cold, you know, since Alisson's been out injured, and I think that's all been down to Van Dijk, has been the glue, probably been the one constant. You've got Gomez, but he's playing in an unfamiliar position. He's obviously been Liverpool's utility man, you know, this season. He starts at left back on Sunday, and then, you know, I was the same as you when you realise that Konate, you know, hasn't made the squad. And as good as Quanta's been, I mean, this is just a different test altogether, because you've got, you know, you've got De Bruyne, who's been magnificent since he's returned from injury. It's one of those, when he finds himself in those pockets, do you go and press him, or do you stand off him? Is it a midfielder's job? So you've got all those decisions to make when a game's been played at, you know, 300 miles per hour.
So only his 6th Premier League start of his career as well, which is absolutely obscene, isn't it?
And I mean, he will have never played in a game like this. I mean, this time last year he was playing in League One for Bristol Rovers, at the bottom of League One, should I add. So, you know, it wasn't even in, you know, precious games in terms of promotion and title races. And then, you know, a year later to find himself up against Van Dijk, up against Haaland. And yeah, I mean, it's one of them. If they played about names and numbers on the back of their shirts, you probably would have struggled to tell who was who, because it's kind of like a Van Dijk light, isn't it? And they did the interview after the game, and it was almost like a father and son. It was like a really proud moment. And as I say, he's another one who's just really stepped up to the mantle this year, and it was probably a year they never expected to have. You can throw Conor Bradley into that conversation. You know, another imperious performance from him. He's so relentless, isn't he, in terms of going up and down. And there was a moment in the first half which I really liked, is when Liverpool, they want to throw in and they were trying to play it quick, and Guardiola had the ball, and Bradley, I mean, you know, what is he, 20-21, and he just ran up to Guardiola and like grabbed the ball out of his hands. Yeah. And I just liked that, because it was like,
he grabbed the ball out of his hands, Guardiola had a little bit of a moan at him, didn't he? And then they shook hands, and that was Bradley who initiated the handshake, which again I think just shows incredible maturity from a player, because we've seen Guardiola on the touchline, he can be a little bit, trying to think of a diplomatic way of saying it, he can wind players up. We saw him try and shake Kostas Tsimikas' hand last season, didn't he, when City scored at the Etihad. So, you know, for Bradley to sort of have the wherewithal, as you say, to not be afraid of him, first of all, and then also, you know, have that respect and initiate him, I really like that.
Well, that's what I mean. It's kind of when you cross the white line, is that, you know, you don't care who you are, who you're up against. It's like, you know, he's thinking, I've been doing this for, you know, the best part of 15 years, and I'm going to do it again, whether I'm playing in, you know, League One on a Tuesday night, or whether I'm playing up against, you know, the reigning European and Premier League champions. He just kind of plays in that same instinctive manner. And I thought he was another one who, I thought the whole Liverpool team took a bit of time to gel, which was understandable given how many changes there was and, you know, how many new combinations there would have been all over the pitch. But he had a run at Ake, you know, quite early on. I can't remember if it was before or after the goal, but it felt like that kind of gave Liverpool that bit of belief that, you know, we're not just going to sit off the mirror, we are going to really give it a go. And that had come after a rocky start to the game where I think, you know, neither side really kept the ball too well. But Bradley kind of thrives on that and was like, well, if you're going to be, you know, misplacing passes, I'm going to pounce on that and I'm going to try and make something happen. And I think it was Nunes at the far post. He slides in and the ball, you know, just goes past him. And another day, Nunes probably taps that in and the ball go 1-0 up. So, yeah, it was, you know, a really pleasing performance from him again. And, you know, the trio of himself, McAllister and Elliot on that right-hand side. I mean, Elliot's another one. I think we forget how old he is. He's what, 20 years of age, and he's, you know, already played over 100 games for Liverpool. And I mean, it feels like 99 of those 100 games have come in the last 6 weeks, because it's just been, you know, since the cup final or even before that. He started at Luton, or started at home to Luton. He plays the cup final for 120 minutes, puts in a stellar performance, and he's not really had a rest since. And I hadn't been critical of Elliot, but I think in December time, after he scored the winner at Palace and he'd had a few decent cameos off the bench, I think of Wolves away at the start of the season as well, I was quite critical because he had failed to take those chances. So it felt like we were stuck in a bit of a cycle of, he plays really well off the bench, gets a Carabao Cup game or a Europa League game, and fair enough, it's a changed side and it's probably hard to make an impact. But then he kind of tailed off, and he maybe gets subbed off on 60, and then, you know, for the next two or three Premier League games, he'd find himself on the bench again. But it feels like in 2024, you know, with the likes of Jones out, with, you know, Salah's obviously had a spell on the sidelines, he's been at AFCON as well, and Elliot's really stepped up, and whether that be on the right of a three or the right of, you know, a forward line, he's done really well, and he's a side in football games. And, you know, you look at someone like Phil Foden on Sunday, and I've thought he's just a class above, isn't he? He's just a really brilliant player who just kind of glides across the turf and the ball kind of just gravitates towards him. And I think I always say with him, he's probably the one English player you'd probably tip to win the Ballon d'Or. There is going to be someone.
Bellingham might have a say on that.
But in terms of, like, if you are South Africa, you're building your team around Bellingham and Foden, aren't you? I mean, they're just two generational talents. And you look at where he was a few years ago. I mean, he must be, what, 23 now or whatever. And there was so much talk about him going out on loan, and, you know, he didn't have the trust of Guardiola at that age. But you look at Harvey Elliott, he's at that age and he's already played 100 games, which I would probably guess is more than Foden managed at that time. And he's coming to a side that, you know, wasn't firing on all cylinders like City have been, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, and certainly when Foden came through. And he's deciding games, and that's just you really got to kind of take your hat off to him and say, to do that at such a young age, but also have that maturity to kind of guide the younger players. I mean, he's younger than Gerard Quansah, which is mad.
And Conor Bradley as well.
Yeah, is, but you would think he's one of the most experienced players, even playing alongside of Darwin Nunes and Luis Diaz, the way he kind of, you know, conducts himself and just has that ability to, he doesn't get flustered in the occasion. There were so many times on Sunday where the second ball would find itself at his feet. And he would just take a touch, you know, open his body out and just switch to play or clip one in behind. And it's just that kind of like nous and know-how, which I think every time I watch him as a 20-year-old, it just blows me away.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
I think probably the biggest compliment that I can pay him is that, you know, probably at the start of the season, if you'd have said he was starting against Manchester City because of injuries, really,
yeah,
you would have maybe felt slightly concerned. But actually on Sunday, you know, when, you know, Mo Salah is waiting on the bench and ready to come on, I was thinking, well, I don't want Harvey Elliott going off the pitch. So I was actually quite glad when Jürgen took Szoboszlai off and obviously Elliott dropped a little bit deeper, which I think sort of sums up that.
And his energy as well in those kind of pockets.
Yeah.
So that, when you talk about City, you find it really hard to get to grips, and, you know, the words that you use, Guardiola said after it was like a tsunami. And you always think of those kind of words of Anfield. You think of like suffocate, and you think of swarming the opposition. And that's exactly, he kind of epitomises that, doesn't he? Of, you know, you're diligent in possession, but when you don't have the ball, you work really hard to get it back. But I mean, you know, when Salah comes on, he obviously makes a difference, doesn't he? And I think one of his first touches is to play that pass to Diaz, but that's just a quality above. But you wouldn't say that was, you know, that wasn't something that Elliott couldn't do himself.
Mm-hmm.
So no, as you say, it was like the tweak, I thought, helped Elliott as well, because then he had Salah, who was, you know, Salah obviously occupies two or three defenders at a time, and then you've got Elliott, you know, really running into that space.
They have a really good relationship, don't they, both on and off the pitch, which I always like seeing them on the pitch together, because I think it brings out the best in Harvey Elliott. We'll move on shortly to what's been going on off the pitch this week in terms of Michael Edwards' return to Liverpool. But just finally, it wouldn't be a Liverpool-related podcast if Darwin Nunez didn't get a mention. I mean, coming into Sunday, I was actually really, you know, confident that he would have a real impact on the game. He'd obviously scored them two goals last week in Prague, two incredible finishes as well. In the first half, he was flagged offside five times on Sunday, which is the joint most in a Premier League game this season. Probably not the stat that he would have wanted to be remembered for from that game. But even though he didn't, you know, he didn't get a goal, he maybe wasn't quite as influential as we'd hoped, he still had a huge impact, didn't he? And I think Liverpool missed that when he went off.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I said it at the top of the show that I felt when Gakpo coming on, I mean, what, 15 minutes from time, whatever it was, it felt like that was maybe Klopp thinking, I'm happy with the point here. You know, we could go and win it if I keep Nunes on, but at the same time, all it takes is one loose pass, as we saw, you know, just for the end of the game. All it takes is, you know, the ball to be played out to Doku, and all of a sudden, you know, that ball bounces at a different angle off the post, it falls to Haaland, then you lose the game 2-1, and you put in one of the best performances of the season. So I think, as you say, the change for Kovacic to come on and kind of steady City up, I think that was Klopp's counter of doing that. But the frustrating side, I think, of Gakpo, I mean, I do slightly feel sorry for him this season, because it felt like he's never really had any rhythm, and he's kind of found himself in that cycle that Harvey Elliott did, which is, you know, a really difficult one to break in terms of, you know, he did really well in the League Cup teams. I think he scored in all the rounds up until all the games up until the final. Again, he's probably Liverpool's leading man in the Europa League. And it felt like, if you kind of date it back, it felt like that, obviously, started the season at Chelsea in midfield, didn't he, when Liverpool were kind of still experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
And it maybe, I mean, I remember I wrote something in the summer saying that he was undroppable, which is just, you know, you look back at it now, 6 months later, you think, who's paying me to write about football? But I suppose the aspect of that is that, We saw last season that Klopp had said to about Nunes that his pressing wasn't, you know, one song, and that was kind of his ticket into the team. I think the phrase was that he used, and Gakpo obviously had that in abundance. You know, probably not as talented as Nunes, and probably doesn't deliver as much as a threat, but in terms of going the other way. But I always think that kind of the landmark moment was the two goals at Newcastle, and it feels like that's kind of swung Klopp's belief and faith in Nunes this season rather than Gakpo. And as I say, he's found himself in that cycle now where he's coming off the bench with little to no time to change a game. And I mean, what do you say to someone when they're coming on with 15 minutes to go against Man City and, you know, in such a high-octane game? It's so hard to involve yourself, isn't it? And I mean, he even had that one chance where it was offside and it hit the post. I'm not really sure how he missed that. I mean, I watched it back a few times and it's one of them. It's obviously harder to execute than it looks, but it just, nothing's kind of fallen for him at the moment. And then you've got the frustration of he drifts out wide a lot and he drifts into midfield a lot, which, you know, Klopp's obviously told him to do, you know, to obviously beef up that midfield and make sure Liverpool kind of retain possession and win that battle. But then the flip side of that is that you lose the focal point of Nunes. And if, you know, if I'm Walker, Kanji and Ake, and if I'm John Stones going into midfield and venturing into those kind of inverted positions, if I've got, you know, some maverick Uruguayan running in behind me and I'm not really sure, you know, which defender he's going to you know, target which side he's going to go down. That just makes your life a hell of a lot harder, doesn't it? And it goes back to what Guardiola said about, you know, Anfield being like a tsunami and, you know, making it difficult for City and kind of, it felt like that decision to bring Gakpo on almost kind of probably ended that tsunami and kind of allowed City to kind of get a foot on the ball as they did and almost see out the game, not comfortably, but with far greater ease than they had done in the first half or the second half. So yeah, I mean, it's difficult with Gakpo. I feel like I've just gone on a tangent of Gakpo, but I do really sympathise with him because I think it's such a difficult task. And I think your initial question, Beth, was about Nunes, which I don't think I've answered at all here.
I think it is a really important. I think the main thing is they're just so different, aren't exactly. they? I think on and off the pitch, they're chalk and cheese, aren't they? In terms of the personality, in terms of the way that they play. I'm a huge fan of Cody Gakpo, and I really, you know, I hope that the fans stick with him, and I hope that.
Well, he showed this time last year. I mean, he was Liverpool shining light in such a torrid time, wasn't he? And you know, you saw when he finally got a run of games. You know, he scores against Everton, he scores against Newcastle, scores two brilliant goals against Manchester United. And it felt like that was him. You know, if you're gonna bring one off the bench, I would say it feels like it would make more sense to bring Nunes off.
Yeah,
he's someone you can kind of just say, you know, go and cause havoc for 15 minutes. You know, go and just hunt down the ball. But with Gakpo, it feels like he's a bit more delicate.
Yeah, he's far more controlled, isn't he? He's very much sort of in the Firmino mold. And I think, you know, had Jurgen Klopp decided that he wanted to continue playing with that false nine, I think Gakpo was the ideal candidate for that. But I think in the way that Liverpool play now, chiefly it is having Nunes as that focal point down the middle. And I think Gakpo hasn't really had a consistent run on the left, which is probably his best position, isn't it? So I do feel for him, and I do hope that, you know, whatever the new manager decides to do when they come in, they give him an opportunity.
As you say, then obviously Liverpool kind of changed how they play recently, haven't they? Well, certainly since Nunes arrived, it's more of an out and out, you know, number nine than it is a control kind of, you know, orchestrator. And to switch between that during games, as you say, to go from almost one extreme in Nunes to Gakpo or vice versa seems quite a difficult task for you know, for whoever is coming on. But I suppose, you know, you can look at a few of the forwards really and say, you know, they've got a big summer coming up. I mean, they've all scored over 10 goals this season, but, you know, in terms of, I'm sure there'll be a few of them who aren't starting as many games or, you know, playing as regularly as they'd like to. And Gakpo's probably someone you'd put into that. I mean, it's all well and good coming off the bench, but in terms of like starting games, and you think this season, obviously Diaz had a bit of period away, didn't he? And obviously Jota's now injured. So it's kind of worked out quite nicely that Liverpool have always had options. But you think, you know, next year Ben Doak will be coming into the limelight a bit more. He'll be, you know, another stage in his development. So all of a sudden you're looking at, you know, five or six really quality forwards. You know, for Gakpo, you know, if Alonso comes in and he plays over 10, that could be his saving grace. If not, you might think, well, you know, I don't want another season being a bit part player, you know, playing games here and there. So I think it is an interesting one because obviously Nunes is 23 and obviously he's the player they've paid the big bucks for. So it feels like if there is someone they're going to persist with, it has been Nunes. And I think that decision this season has largely, you know, paid off because. You know, he's had a far, not that he had a bad season last year, but he looks a far more complete player in terms of, you know, going both ways, doesn't he?
Yeah, I did hear a fun fact this morning from our esteemed colleague, Ian Doyle. He asked me actually who did I think, without looking, had played the most games, made the most appearances for Liverpool this season. So I went with Harvey Elliott and Van Dijk initially, but it turns out it's actually Cody Gakpo and Darwin Nunes.
Just proves everything I've just said.
No, but I think, you know, I don't know how that breaks down in terms of coming off the bench and which competitions, but I think it maybe sums up the fact that Cody Gakpo has had to sort of be
Jack of all trades.
He's, you know, you throw him in to fill in, you know, for Jota when he is injured, or Diaz when he's out, or Nunes when he's out. And I think, you know, that is hard for a player. And for Darwin Nunes as well, you know, to be up in that category is really positive that he's, you know, he's making such an impact now on this Liverpool team. But we'll move on from that game at the weekend, because there has been a huge development behind the scenes at Liverpool this week with the news that Michael Edwards is returning to the club in a new role, not as sporting director, but as chief executive of football for FSG. So Mike Gordon, the FSG president, who will be sort of ceding quite a lot of responsibility now to Michael Edwards from the football perspective. But he describes him as one of the most formidable executive talent in world football, which is a, you know, high praise indeed. I think, you know, the overwhelming response has been really, really positive. It's looking likely that it's going to be Richard Hughes from Bournemouth who comes in as his sporting director. It feels like all the pieces now have fallen into place for a life without Jurgen Klopp, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, the kind of reaction to Edwards' announcement and even the fact that talks are taking place over the last, you know, couple of weeks is you know, a world away from what the sport was 10 years ago. And it just kind of shows those marginal gains, doesn't it, that, you know, Liverpool have had to seek to, you know, to compete with Manchester City, you know, on a Premier League and Champions League stage. And I mean, I wrote a piece yesterday basically saying that as a sporting director, I don't think anyone should really know who you are, but he's done such a good job at Liverpool, and he's got such a legacy that, I mean, I'd said in the piece that he's a name that is held in the same regard now as Van Dijk and Salah, and I stand by that. You know, you only have to look at the statement FSG released yesterday and what Mike Gordon said about him, and also how persistent they were in trying to get him back in some capacity. So, you know, initially, you know, that was they'd hoped that would be a sporting director role. Obviously, Mike Gordon has taken a step back now, so they've created this new, you know, CEO of football role for him, and that just shows. I mean, the Athletic report, it's a multi-million pound salary, which, you know, obviously very nice indeed, but it just kind of shows how much trust you know, FSG have got in him for his work over the last 10 years. You know, the fact that he rejected approaches from Chelsea and United as well, I think is quite reassuring for FSG, because you've got someone who's, you know, won a lot with Liverpool, but still feels like this new challenge, whatever was pitched to him in a post-Klopp world, it still feels like, you know, it's still compelling, it still excites him. And that's something he had referenced in his, you know, in his leaving letter 2 years ago. He said that he believes change is good. And obviously he's had this time away from Liverpool and from Premier League. He's obviously set up his own consultancy agency with Ian Graham. But the fact now that, you know, this kind of leading role with FSG is enough to excite him. And yes, there will, you know, as FSG have said, there will be another club eventually added to that, to their portfolio, another football club. But primarily, his first job will be to appoint a sporting director, and his second job will be, or, you know, whichever way around it is, to find Jurgen Klopp's successor. So clearly, you know, this guy who, as I say, has won a lot of Liverpool and been such an instrumental part of their recent success, and I kind of, you know, this is the level Liverpool want to go back to. They want to be winning Premier Leagues, they want to be winning Champions Leagues, and I just think to have someone around who's experienced all that, not only in the same league but also at the same club, he knows the people, because I think over the last 18 months it probably has gone a bit under the radar how many people have left. You know, obviously Julian Ward was his assistant sporting director, he took over, and within 3 months he handed in his notice. Ian Graham left shortly after. You know, Jurgen Klopp, the whole backroom staff are going to be leaving this summer. You know, so that's Pep Linders' experience. You lose, who's someone who's, you know, progressed through the academy teams. You know, you might have John Akterberg as well who leaves. So there's so many, you know, people who've been foundations of the club over the last 10 years, and all of a sudden if they're not there and you've got, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 people learning on the job, that can be quite daunting. But if you have a figure who you can turn to and say, well, not how do we replicate this, but what would they have done, or how did they go about doing this? I think it's a really positive thing move for Liverpool and FSG, and one that clearly, if you know, judging by the reactions of social media and, you know, speaking to people, it's one that certainly stirred a lot of excitement.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it takes a village, doesn't it, to sign a Premier League player, and I think Michael Edwards gets a lot of praise for his recruitment during his time as sporting director, and maybe some of that is overhyped a little bit, in the sense that he obviously has a whole recruitment team around him, a lot of the guys doing data, the manager will have a say as well. Obviously, when a new sporting director comes in, they will probably have a huge say in who Liverpool sign. So Michael Edwards won't be sort of the sole figure who's signing players for Liverpool. But just to look back on his full list of signings, because I actually couldn't remember the full list earlier on, but I'll go through it now. So we've got Mo Salah, Andy Robertson, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Dominic Solanke, Virgil van Dijk, Fabinho, Alisson Becker, Naby Keita, Jadon Sancho, Harvey Elliott, Seth Vandenberg, Adrian, Andy Lonergan, Minamino, Tsimikas, Jota, Thiago, Ben Davis, Konate and Diaz, which was obviously done in conjunction with Julian Ward as well. That is some list of players, and I think regardless of how big a role he has in Liverpool's recruitment going forward, having him there, as you say, sort of overseeing everything as a reference point, that is hugely reassuring, isn't it?
Absolutely, and you talk about contact as well. That's part of the game, isn't it? That's part of football. It's not what you know, it's who you know, and clearly he's dealt with, you know, you go through all those signings and you know, yes, you've got the likes of Van Dijk, you've got Alisson, but you've also got, you know, people like Mo Salah, who at the time people forget were quite unprovable. They were unproven in the Premier League, and there was a lot of, you know, will he, you know, there was a lot of doubt around his signing. I think United had signed Mkhitaryan at the time, and a lot of people were kind of pointing at that, saying, you know, was he someone Liverpool should have gone for? I think it was a year earlier or whatever. You've also got players like, you know, Dominic Solanke. Okay, they didn't have the career they had at Liverpool, but clearly that talent identification, you know, he's probably a player who's, you know, if he's sold from Bournemouth this summer, he's probably going to cost someone, you know, in the region of 40 to 50 million. He'll probably become a fully fledged England international fairly soon as well. So even the ones that haven't been hit at Anfield, I mean, you even look at Ben Davies, I think he buys him for 2 million. He stays for 6 months and he goes for 4.5. It's, you know, you find it hard to find a player who's failed at Anfield or certainly hasn't. Yeah, they might not be your typical definition of success, but in a profit and loss column, they all will be in some regard. So I think that's really reassuring. And obviously Richard Hughes sounds like he is going to be the new sporting director. And, you know, so that's someone that Michael Edwards has, you know, had a relationship with for the time at Portsmouth, you know, in the early 2000s. So again, it's who you know. And clearly between the pair of them, they've got a very good contacts book. And hopefully, you know, this kind of, as you say, the pieces are now starting to fall into place. And yes, it's such a daunting, you know, prospect of Jurgen Klopp leaving. It's, I think I said it in this piece that I wrote, that it's probably the most daunting to replace it. It's probably the most daunting task Liverpool ever had in their history. Because even if you look at when Bill Shankly left, they had Bob Paisley. It was that boot room culture of, you know, one after the other after the other. So to go out and find, you know, someone who isn't going to be the next Jurgen Klopp, but can, you know, come into Anfield and be their own man, I think is a really daunting thing for not only the manager but also the person recruiting. But to have someone like Edwards there, whose track record across, you know, all kind of realms of the club and kind of all the remits and different roles he's had, I think is a really exciting proposition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just finally then, moving on to the games coming up over the next week before the international break. So we've got Sparta Prague in the second leg in the Europa League on Thursday at Anfield, and then we've got Manchester United at Old Trafford in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup. So a busy few days. I mean, Liverpool have pretty much, touch wood, got the job done in the Europa League. What sort of team do you think he's going to put out there on Thursday?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I was actually doing an 11 beforehand, and there isn't many choices to choose from. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was me, I'd probably throw Adrian in there. I mean, obviously the game against United is a massive one. It's one game away from a return to Wembley. It's also the fact that it's at United, you know, with 9,000 Liverpool supporters. I mean, it doesn't get, you know, there's no such thing as a weekend off or a game off in that respect, is there? But also the fact, I think, that they go to United a few weeks after in the league. And if you were to, you know, it's probably a great time to play them in the FA Cup as well, because you can always have a dress rehearsal of what that league game is going to be. And, you know, you're looking at a time when Liverpool can't really afford to drop points in the league. You've obviously then got to go strong, really strong at Old Trafford. You know, if you beat them 2-0 or 3-0 and then you go and rock it up there in the league 2 weeks later, mm-hmm. all of a sudden that daunting task of going to United, it becomes a far easier one, doesn't it? So yeah, I think he has got to go pretty strong there. So you obviously almost work backwards. You probably wrap Kelleher in cotton wool. It's obviously 5-1 on aggregate, isn't it? So, you know, hopefully Adrian doesn't go and concede four or five goals. That would be disastrous. But you're probably looking at it and thinking you probably put Bradley in. Kanate doesn't sound like he's going to be fit, so you're probably asking Quansah and Gomez to go again. Then you're probably bringing Simakas in at fullback. Then the midfield again, there's not huge options. You probably Bobby Clark and James McConnell come in, and then it's one of either Szoboszlai or McAllister. I would probably go with Szoboszlai just to get him up to rhythm. It's a game where he's probably going to be on the ball a lot more than he was on Sunday. It allows him to kind of continue his rehabilitation and come back from, you know, a couple of weeks out. McAllister, as we said, has played an awful lot of football recently, so again, wrapping him in cotton wool. And then in attack, it's again, who do you pick? I mean, do you call on some of the academy lads? Do you call on a Lewis Kumas or a Jadon Dans? I'm not sure. You know, you might throw one of them in, but then you're asking at least one of Nunes, Diaz. I mean, I wouldn't even put Elliot in the squad, to be honest. Like, again, I'd wrap him in cotton wool with the amount of football he's played. So then you're probably saying, well, give Salah 45 minutes, you know, let him get a goal or whatever, and then again, just kind of protect him for that trip to United. So I'm not sure if there's if you've got any.
Yeah, no, I was completely agree with that. I think the back line probably does pick itself because there's only three centre-halves who are eligible to play in this competition for Liverpool. Virgil van Dijk, I wouldn't be letting anywhere near the pitch. I'll be having maybe give him the whole night off, I think. And then, as you say, I think that the back line is sort of pretty self-explanatory. I think the midfield as well, he's got options. I think the forward line's probably where he's going to go the strongest because I imagine Cody Gakpo probably starts. I think Mo Salah probably starts in terms of giving him a chance to get up to speed. But hopefully, you know, touch wood, there'll be no injuries.
Well, that's it. Getting an early goal is nice, done, isn't it? You know, be sure that you get between, you know, whether it's Gakpo, Salah, Nunes, Diaz, you know, one of the young lads, surely they've got enough to... I mean, we saw last week Sparta Prague were quite open, weren't they? They're defending... Mm-hmm. Wasn't exactly to be desired. If you all of a sudden you make that 6-1 in the first 20 minutes, then as you say, you can bring Salah off on at half time, and then, you know, his night's done, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I'm sure that the Blood Red lads will get into the United game in more detail later in the week. But just sort of one thing that I wanted to mention, United obviously go and they beat Everton last weekend. Sorry to our producer Ian, who is of an Everton persuasion.
Giving you a snarl then.
But Everton actually played pretty well, yeah, for a lot of that game, and it was the fifth time in the last six Premier League games that United have faced more than 20 shots. That is a really alarming statistic if you're a Manchester United fan, and that's something that's, you know, Darwin Nunez, Mohamed Salah, they've got to be licking the lips ahead of this one on Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely. United are kind of a weird side, aren't they, at the moment, because, you know, they've won a lot. They've won, you know, well, apart from the Everton game and I think the Fulham game a few weeks ago. Sorry, they haven't again, but the full year a few weeks ago, they actually put a decent run of games together over the last, you know, 10 weeks or so. But I don't think any of those performances have been convincing. And, you know, they win at Wolves late. I think they were 2 or 3-0 up. They sacrificed that lead and it takes Kobbie Mainoo, who won the goal, to win the game. Luton as well, they made hard work of the FA Cup game against Newport, they made hard work of as well. So if you're Liverpool, yeah, you see a lot of green on, you know, there's been a lot of wins, but if you kind of delve into those wins, which obviously they will do, there's no reason really to be worried. I don't think it's... And for United, obviously, they've not got a great deal to play for, obviously, now the end of the season. Yes, they're chasing top four, but whether they'll actually, you know, break into that, I have my doubts, I have my reservations. So it feels like for Ten Hag to kind of save his United career and maybe buy himself, you know, the trust of you know, the new owners, it feels like he is going to have to win a trophy, and the FA Cup is a respectable trophy. It's, you know, it's got a, you know, a huge prestige, hasn't it? And if you were to knock Liverpool out and, you know, later beat City or knock City out, I think that would carry enough weight for the owners to maybe, you know, think, all right, we'll give him another transfer window, give him another half-season charge, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it feels like for United, for Liverpool, you know, it certainly isn't their biggest game. Mm-hmm. Even of the month of March, really, you'd argue that the Brighton game is probably a bigger game than that. But for United, it is really going to be like a cup final for them. So, yeah, it is interesting. It's going to be a difficult one to call. And obviously, we know playing at Old Trafford, Liverpool struggled there. Not just under Jurgen Klopp, but, you know, under, you know, every manager, they've not won there a great deal. Obviously, Klopp's been better there recent times. They've had the 5-0, the 4-2. But certainly, I think at times, and even when, you know, United have come to Anfield, I think when the two teams meet each other, they're never on par. You know, one team's doing really well and one's kind of struggling. But, you know, that game of Liverpool versus United kind of always produces and it always can cause upset. So Liverpool just needs to make sure that they're not on the wrong end of one of those on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have all the reaction to that game next week. We've got an international break coming up, which is good for my nerves. It means I don't have to sit biting my nails every 3 days. But for now, thank you very much for listening to Analyzing Anfield, and we'll see you soon.
You've been listening to the Blood Red podcast from the Liverpool Echo.